The Monday was Sally Ann's birthday. After breakfast, they drove across to Queen's Lynn together to fetch her present. Craig had left it in the care of Mrs. Groenewald, the overseer's wife, to preserve the secrecy and surprise.
Oh, Craig, he's beautiful!
Now you have two of us to keep you at King's Lynn, he told her. Sally Ann lifted the honey-coloured puppy in both hands and kissed his wet nose, and the puppy licked her back. He's a Rhodesian lion dog, Craig told her. Or now I suppose you would call him a Zimbabwean lion dog. The puppy's skin was too big for him. It hung down in wrinkles over his forehead that gave him a worried frown. His back was crested in the distinctive ridge of his breed.
Look at his paws, Sally Ann cried. He's going to be a monster. What shall I call him?
Craig declared a public holiday to mark the occasion of Sally Ann's birth. They took the puppy and a picnic lunch down to the main dam below the homestead and lay on a rug under the trees at the water's edge and tried to find a name for the puppy. Sally Ann vetoed, Craig suggested, dog. The black-faced weaver birds fluttered and shrieked and hung upside down from their basket-shaped nests above their heads, and Joseph had put a cold bottle of white wine in the basket. The puppy chased grasshoppers until he collapsed exhausted on the rug beside Sally Ann. They finished the wine, and when they made love on the rug, Sally Ann whispered seriously, "Shh, don't wake the puppy." They drove back up the hills, and Sally Ann said suddenly, "We haven't spoken about the troubles all day."
"Oh, don't let's spoil our record."
"I'm going to call him Buster."
"Why?"
"The first puppy I was ever given, I called Buster."
They gave Buster his supper in the bowl labelled dog Craig had bought for him, and then made a bed in an empty wine crate near the Arga stove. They were both happily tired, and that evening left the book and the photographs and went to bed immediately after their own meal. Craig woke to the sound of gunfire. His residual war reflexes hurled him from the bed before he was fully awake. It was automatic rifle fire, short bursts, very close, he noted instinctively. Short bursts meant good trained riflemen. They were down by the farm village or the workshop. He judged the distance. He found his leg and clinched the strap, fully awake now, and his first thought was for Sally Ann. Keeping low beneath the sill level of the windows, he rolled back to the bed and dragged her down beside him. She was naked and muzzy with sleep.
"What is it?"
"Here." He whipped her gown off the foot of the bed. "Get dressed, but keep down." While she shrugged into the gown, he was trying to marshal his thoughts. There were no weapons in the house except the kitchen knives and a small hand axe for chopping firewood on the back veranda. There was no sandbag fallback position, no defensive perimeter of wire and floodlights, no radio transmitter. None of even the most elementary defences with which every farm homestead had once been provided. Another burst of rifle fire, and somebody screamed. A woman. The faint scream abruptly cut off.
"What's happening? Who are they?"
Sally Ann's voice was level and crisp. She was awake and unafraid. He felt a little lift of pride for her.
"Are they dissidents?"
"I don't know, but we aren't going to wait around to find out," he told her grimly. He glanced up at the new, highly inflammable thatch overhead. Their best chance was to get out of the house and into the bush. To do that, they needed a diversion.
"Stay here," he ordered. "Get your shoes on and be ready to run. I'll be back in a minute."
He rolled under the window to the wall and came to his feet. The bedroom door was unlocked, and he darted into the passage. He wasted 10 seconds on the telephone. He knew they would have cut the wires, and that was confirmed immediately by the dead, echoless void in the earpiece. He dropped it dangling on the cord and ran through to the kitchens. There was only one diversion he could think of. Light. He hit the remote control switch of the diesel generator, and there was the faint ripple of sound from the engine room across the yard, and the overhead bulbs glowed yellow and then flared into full brilliance. He tore open the fuse box above the control board, tripped out the house lights, and then switched on the veranda and front garden lights. That would leave the back of the house in darkness. They would make their break that way, he decided, and it would have to be quick. The attackers hadn't hit the house yet, but they could only be seconds away. He ran back out of the kitchen, paused at the door of the lounge, and glanced through it to check the lighting in the front garden and veranda. The lawns were a peculiarly lush green in the artificial light. The jacaranda trees domed over them like the roof of a cathedral. The firing had ceased, but down near the labourer's village, a woman was keening that doleful sound of African mourning. It made his skin creep. Craig knew that they had been coming up the hill already, and he was turning away to go back to Sally Ann when he caught a flicker of movement at the edge of the light, and he narrowed his eyes and tried to identify it. To know who was attacking would give him some small advantage, but he was wasting precious seconds. The movement was a running man, coming up towards the house. A black man, naked. No, he was wearing a loincloth. Not really running, but staggering and weaving drunkenly. In the veranda lights, half his body glinted as though he had been freshly oiled. And then Craig realized that it was blood. The man was painted with his own blood, and it was falling in scattered drops from him like water from the coat of a retriever when it comes ashore with the duck in its jaws. Then a more intense shock of horror. Craig realized that it was old Shadrach, and unthinkingly went to help him. He kicked open the French doors of the lounge, went out onto the veranda at a run, and vaulted the low half-wall. He caught Shadrach in his arms just as he was about to fall, and lifted him off his feet. He was surprised at how light was the old man's body. Craig carried him at a single bound onto the veranda, and crouched with him below the low wall. Shadrach had been hit in the upper arm, just above the elbow. The bone had shattered, and the limb hung by a ribbon of flesh. Shadrach held it to his breast like a nursing infant.
"They are coming," he gasped at Craig. "You must run. They are killing our people. They will kill you also."
It was miraculous that the old man could speak, let alone move and run with such a wound. Crouching below the wall, he ripped a strip of cotton from his loincloth with his teeth and started to bind it around his own arm above the wound. Craig pushed his hand away and tied the knot for him.
"You must run, little master."
And before Craig could prevent him, the old man rolled to his feet and disappeared into the darkness beyond the floodlights. "He risked his life to warn me." Craig looked after him for a second, and then roused himself, and doubled over, ran back into the house. Sally Ann was where he had left her, crouched below the window. Light fell through it in a yellow square, and he saw that she had tied back her hair and pulled on a T-shirt and shorts and was lacing her soft leather training shoes.
"Good girl,"
he knelt beside her.
"Let's go."
"Buster," she replied, "my puppy.
For God's sake."
"We can't leave him."
She had that stubborn look that he had already come to know so well.
"I'll carry you if I have to,"
he warned fiercely, and raising himself quickly, he risked a last glance over the windowsill. The lawns and the garden were still brightly lit. There were the dark shapes of men coming up from the valley, armed men in disciplined extended order. For a moment he could not believe what he was seeing, and then he sagged with relief.
"Oh, thank you, God," he whispered.
He found that reaction had set in already. He felt weak and shivery, and he took Sally Ann in his arms and hugged her.
"It's all right now," he told her. "It's going to be all right."
"What has happened?"
"The security forces have arrived," he said.
He had recognized the burgundy-colored berets and silver cap badges of the men closing in across the lawns.
"The 3rd Brigade is here. We'll be all right now."
They went out onto the front veranda to greet their rescuers, Sally Ann carrying the yellow puppy in her arms, and Craig with his arm about her shoulders.
"I'm very glad to see you and your men, Sergeant," Craig greeted the non-commissioned officer, who led the advancing line of troopers. "Please go inside."
The sergeant made a gesture with his rifle, imperative, if not directly threatening. He was a tall man with long, sinewy limbs. His expression was cold and neutral, and Craig felt his relief shrink. Something was wrong. The line of troopers had closed like a net around the homestead, while skirmishers came forward in pairs, covering each other, the classical tactics of the street fighter. And they went swiftly into the house, breaking through windows and side doors, sweeping the interior. There was a crash of breaking glass at the rear of the house. It was a destructive search.
"What's going on, Sergeant?"
Craig's anger resurfaced, and this time the tall sergeant's gesture was unmistakably hostile. Craig and Sally Ann backed off before him into the dining room and stood in the centre of the room beside the teak refectory table, facing the threatening rifle, Craig holding her protectively. Two troopers slipped in through the front door and reported to the sergeant in a gabble of Shona that Craig could not follow. The sergeant acknowledged with a nod and gave them an order. They spread out obediently along the wall, their weapons turned unmistakably onto the dishevelled couple in the centre of the room.
"Where are the lights?" the sergeant asked.
And when Craig told him, he went to the switch and white light flooded the room. "What's going on here, sergeant?" Craig repeated, angry and uncertain, and starting to be afraid for Sally Ann again. The sergeant ignored the question and strode to the door. He called to one of the troopers on the lawn, and the man came at a run. He carried a portable radio transmitter strapped on his back, with the scorpion tail aerial sticking up over his shoulder. The sergeant spoke softly into the handset of the radio and then came back into the room. They waited now in an unmoving tableau. To Craig it seemed like an hour passed in silence, but it was less than 5 minutes before the sergeant cocked his head slightly, listening. Craig heard it, the beat of an engine, in a different tempo from that of the diesel generator. It firmed, and Craig knew that it was a Land Rover. It came up the driveway, headlights swept the windows, brakes squeaked, and gravel crunched. The engine was cut, doors banged, and then there were footsteps of a group of men crossing the veranda. General Peter Fongabera led his staff in through the French doors. He wore his beret pulled down over one eye, and a matching silk scarf at his throat. Except for the pistol in its webbing holster at his side, he was armed only with the leather-covered swagger stick. Behind him, Captain Timon Mbebe was tall and round-shouldered, his eyes inscrutable behind steel-rimmed spectacles. He carried a leather map case in his hand and a machine pistol on a sling over his shoulder. "Peter!" Craig's relief was tempered by wariness. It was all too contrived, too controlled, too menacing. "Some of my people have been killed. My Induna is out there somewhere, badly wounded." "There have been many enemy casualties," Peter Fungabera nodded. "Enemy?" Craig was puzzled. "Dissidents," Peter nodded again. "Matabili dissidents." "Dissidents?" Craig stared at him. "Shadrach, a dissident? That's crazy. He's a simple, uneducated cattleman. He doesn't give a damn for politics." "Things are often not what they seem." Peter Fungabera pulled back the chair at the head of the long table and placed one foot on it, leaning an elbow on his knee. Timon Mbebe placed the leather map case on the table in front of him and stood back in a position of guard behind his shoulder, holding the machine pistol by the grip. "Will somebody please tell me what in the hell is happening here, Peter?" Craig was exasperated and nervous. "Somebody attacked my village. They've killed some of my people, God alone knows how many. Why don't you get after them?" "The shooting is over," Peter Fungabera told him. "We have cleaned out the viper's nest of traitors that you were breeding on this colonial-style estate of yours." "What on earth are you talking about?" Craig was now truly flustered. "You cannot be serious." "Serious?" Peter smiled easily. He straightened up and placed both feet back on the floor. He walked across to face them. "A puppy," he was still smiling. "How adorable." He took Buster from Sally Ann's arms before she realized his intentions. He strolled back to the head of the table, fondling the little animal, scratching behind its ear. It was still half asleep, and it made little whimpering sounds, nuzzling against him, instinctively searching for its mother's teat. "Serious?" Peter repeated the original question. "I want to impress upon you just how serious I am." He dropped the puppy onto the stone flag floor. It fell on its back and lay stunned. He placed his boot upon its chest and crushed it with his full weight. The puppy screamed once only, as its chest collapsed. "That is how serious I am." He was no longer smiling. "Your lives are as valuable to me as this animal was." Sally Ann made a small moaning sound and turned away, burying her face in Craig's chest. She heaved with nausea, and Craig could feel her fighting to control it. Peter Fungabera kicked the soft yellow corpse into the fireplace and sat down.
"We have wasted enough time on the theatricals," he said, and opened the leather map case, spreading the documents on the table in front of him. "Mr. Mello, you have been acting as an agent provocateur in the pay of the notorious American CIA." "That's a bloody lie," Craig shouted, and Peter ignored the outburst. "Your local control was the American agent Morgan Oxford at the United States Embassy, while your central control and paymaster was a certain Henry Pickering, who masquerades as a senior official of the World Bank in New York. He recruited both you and Miss J. That is not true. Your remuneration was $60,000 per annum, and your mission was to set up a center of subversion in Matabeleland, which was financed by CIA monies channeled to you in the form of a loan from a CIA-controlled subsidiary of the World Bank. The sum allocated was $5 million. Christ, Peter, that's nonsense, and you know it. During the rest of this interrogation, you will address me either as Sir or General Fongabera. Is that clear to you?
He turned away to listen, as there was sudden activity outside the French doors. It sounded like the arrival of a convoy of light trucks, from which more troops were disembarking with orders being called in Schoner. Through the glass doors, Craig saw a dozen troopers carrying heavy crates up onto the veranda. Peter Fongabera glanced inquiringly at Timon Mbebe, who nodded in confirmation of the unspoken question.
"Right," Peter Fongabera turned back to face Craig. "We can continue. You opened negotiations with known Matabele traitors, using your fluent knowledge of the language and the character of these intractable people. You can't name one because there weren't any."
Peter Fongabera nodded to Timon Mbebe. He shouted an order.
A man was led into the room between two troopers. He was barefooted, dressed only in ragged khaki shorts, and was emaciated to the point where his head appeared grotesquely huge. His pate was shaven and covered with lumps and fresh scabs, his ribs latticed with scars of beatings. Probably the wicked hippo hide whips called shamboks had been used on him.
"Do you know this white man?" Peter Fongabera demanded of him.
The man stared at Craig. His eyes had an opaque dullness, as though they had been sprinkled with dust.
"I've never seen it,"
Craig started, and then broke off as he recognized him. It was Comrade Dollar, the youngest and most truculent of the men from Zambezi Waters.
"Yes," Peter Fongabera invited, smiling again. "What were you about to say, Mr. Mello?"
"I want to see someone from the British High Commission," Craig said, "and Miss J would like to make a telephone call to the United States Embassy."
"Of course," Peter Fongabera nodded. "All in good time, but first we must complete what we have already begun."
He swung back to Comrade Dollar.
"Do you know this white man?"
Comrade Dollar nodded.
He gave us money." "Take him away," Peter Fongabera ordered. "Care for him well, and give him something to eat. Now, Mr. Mello, do you still deny any contact with the subversives?"
He did not wait for a reply, but went on smoothly.
"You built up an arsenal of weapons on this estate to be used against the elected people's government in a coup d'etat which would place a pro-American dictator."
"No," Craig said quietly. "I have no weapons."
Peter Fongabera sighed.
"Your denials are pointless and tiresome."
Then to the tall Schoner sergeant.
"Bring the two of them."
He led the way onto the wide veranda, to where his men had stacked the crates.
"Open them,"
he commanded, and his men knocked back the clips and lifted the lids. Craig recognized the weapons that were packed into them. They were American Armalite 5.56mm AR-18 automatic rifles, six to the case and brand new, still in their factory grease.
"These are nothing to do with me,"
Craig was at last able to deny it with vehemence.
"You are testing my patience." Peter Fongabera turned to Timon Mbebe. "Fetch the other white man."
Hans Grunewald, Craig's overseer, was dragged from the cab of one of the parked trucks and led to the veranda. His hands were manacled behind his back and he was terrified. His broad, tanned face seemed to have deflated into heavy wrinkles and folds of loose skin like a diseased bloodhound, and his dark suntan had faded to the colour of creamed coffee. His eyes were bloodshot and rheumy, like those of a drunkard.
"You stored these weapons in the tractor sheds on this ranch?" Peter Fongabera asked,
and Grunewald's reply was inaudible.
"Speak up, man!"
Yes, I stored them, sir.
On whose orders?
Grunewald looked piteously at Craig. And suddenly, Craig's heart was sheathed in ice, and the cold spread down into his belly and his loins.
Whose orders?
Peter Fungabera repeated patiently. Mr. Mello's orders, sir.
Take him away.
As the guards led him back to the truck, Grunewald's head was screwed around. His eyes still on Craig's face, his expression harrowed. Suddenly he shouted, I'm sorry, Mr. Mello, I've got a wife and kids. One of the guards swung the butt of his rifle into Grunewald's stomach, just below the ribs. Grunewald gasped and doubled over. He would have fallen, but they seized his arms and swung him up into the cab. The driver of the truck started the engine, and the big machine roared away down the hill. Peter Fungabera led them back into the dining room and resumed his seat at the head of the table. While he rearranged and studied the papers from the map case, he ignored Craig and Sally Ann. They were forced to stand against the opposite wall, a trooper on each side of them, and the silence stretched out. Even though Craig realized this silence was deliberate, he wanted to break it, to shout out his innocence, to protest against the web of lies and half-truths and distortions in which they were being slowly enmeshed.